Thank you, Mr. Regnery. Ladies and gentlemen. After writing this paper, I gave it a title, and I called it Reflections of a, quote, conservative liberal, unquote. And in a sense, what the paper is about are those quotation marks. Some months ago, I had a telephone call from a newspaper man who was asking a group of people, mainly survivors of the old anti-communist left, how they would today define themselves politically. Conservative, liberal, radical. I thought for maybe 5 seconds and said, conservative, liberal, or liberal, conservative, take your choice. He pressed me a bit, and I finally said, oh, well, I suppose conservative, liberal suits me a bit better. And so it appeared in print the next day. I have been intermittently brooding over that incident ever since. I find myself being nagged, not only by my lack of theoretical certitude, but also by the feeling that this lack of theoretical certitude itself needs explaining. I am not ordinarily indifferent to matters of political philosophy, and even tend to think that political philosophy shapes the world of politics to a far greater degree than it is shaped by it. I therefore find myself uncomfortable in my equivocation. That word liberal is more than a little misleading as applied to my political outlook. The plain fact is that I can rarely find a kind thing to say about all those other Americans who call themselves liberal. On the other hand, the term conservative does not much appeal to me either. Most of the time, I don't know what it means. And when someone steps forward to articulate its meaning, I rather wish he hadn't. It is all confusing and more than a little depressing. A man of my age and experience really ought to know where he stands. And I take no pleasure in being ideologically déraciné. So I have been wrestling with this problem for some time now, and I have come to some tentative conclusions. The first is that I would indeed like to be a conservative. The second is that, precisely because I would like to be a conservative, I cannot be an American conservative, as that species is variously understood today. And the third is that, for me to realize my desire to be a conservative, I have to be in favor of several reforms, perhaps even many reforms, usually thought to be liberal. This is not really as mixed up as it sounds, nor is it a terribly subtle and highly personal accommodation, one that is idiosyncratic and of no general relevance. I think these three conclusions flow less from my own personal bewilderment than from the condition of American society and of American civilization. A society and civilization that is essentially dynamic, which is to say, anti-conservative in its deepest principles. This kind of society and civilization is peculiar to the modern world, the world since the Industrial and French Revolutions. And that is why earlier models of conservatism and or liberalism have only an indirect, though important, bearing upon what it means to be a liberal and or conservative today. Our condition is without precedent. It is not surprising, therefore, that so many of us may be confused to an unprecedented degree. I rather think there is no need to explain at this time, in this place, to this audience, why I am not a liberal in the contemporary or 20th century sense of that term. A sense in which it differs little from what is also called democratic socialist. Suffice it to say that I find liberalism today to be trapped in an impossible set of contradictions. To try to combine a large measure of economic collectivism with a decent measure of personal liberty may or may not be impossible, as Mr. Hayek says. It certainly is not a probable combination on the face of it. But to combine economic collectivism and personal liberty and a materialist hedonistic ethic is indeed as impossible as squaring the circle. For collectivism and liberty can only exist together when people freely practice self-restraint and self-denial and self-sacrifice, as, for instance, on the Israeli kibbutz. When their personal liberty becomes truly personal, when they enjoy individual pleasures more than a sense of collective identity, then the whole arrangement collapses. Precisely something of this sort, I understand, is now happening on the Israeli kibbutz. What this comes down to is the fact, and I believe it to be a fact, that economic collectivism can only be wedded to personal liberty when this union rests on a religious basis. Whether this be a transcendental religion or a civic religion is not too important. What is important is that people should find their greatest personal satisfaction, and hence their most perfect expression of liberty, in sacrificing their personal pleasures to the common good. And such a community, of course, is not a liberal society at all, in our sense of that term. The Greek polis, the medieval monastery, the utopian socialist colony, are the very antitheses of our kind of liberal society, where each individual is encouraged to do and think as he pleases, except when he begins to think and act in violation of the law, at which moment legal and forceful intervention constrains him to do and think otherwise. The inherently unstable relationship among these three points of the liberal triangle, economic collectivism, personal liberty, and a materialistic, hedonistic ethic, means that, to an ever greater extent, liberal self-government is always suffering encroachment by bureaucratic government. And there's not much sense in complaining that the bureaucracy is soulless and mindless. Of course it is. That is the nature of bureaucracy. If, nevertheless, such complaints are being made today, and with ever-increasing intensity, this simply testifies to the fact that most liberals are discovering that their version of the good society is, in the event, a society acceptable, unacceptable, even to them. That they should not recognize or admit this is, of course, entirely to be expected. That they should blame non-liberals for this state of affairs is also to be expected. Men do not give up their ideological commitments lightly. They will not even re-examine them until the pressure to do so becomes irresistible. So much for 20th century liberalism. There is more that can and should be said, but indeed it has already been said by others, including many who are here today, and I really have little of significance to add. My problems with conservatism are of a different order. I have said that I would like to be a conservative, and when I read Michael Oakeshott's description of the conservative predisposition, as he calls it, I recognize a kindred spirit and temperament. He writes, "The general characteristics of this disposition center upon a propensity to use and enjoy what is available, rather than to wish for or look for something else. To delight in what is present rather than what was or what may be. What is esteemed is the present, and it is esteemed not on account of its connections with a remote antiquity, nor because it is recognized to be more admirable than any possible alternative, but on account of its familiarity. To be a conservative, then, is to prefer the familiar to the unknown, to prefer the tried to the untried, fact to mystery, the actual to the possible, the limited to the unfounded, the sufficient to the superabundant." The conservative, Mr. Oakeshott goes on to say, is willing to suffer change, but he experiences it as a kind of deprivation, and he is reluctant to innovate, most especially reluctant to innovate in any large and sudden way. As I have said, I respond instinctively to this description of the ideal conservative. That's the kind of person I take myself at bottom to be. I am attached to familiar things and to customary habits. I am the sort of person on whom advertisers waste their money, for I almost never switch brands and never purchase new products while they are still new. I prefer to eat always in the same restaurant, stay at the same hotel, do my writing with the same kind of pen on the same kind of paper. And I prefer to watch on TV reruns of old movies rather than learn the latest news. More Moreover, I think I've always been this kind of person, even when I was young and a radical socialist, which suggests perhaps that behind the radical impulse of our times, there lies a deep yearning for stability, as much as a mindless urge to innovate. But much as I admire Michael Oakeshott, I have my problems with him. On a general level, I find him, well, let's say, a bit Philistine in a very British way. The conservative predisposition, I think, cannot be celebrated with quite so unqualified an enthusiasm. Some allowance ought to be made for the authentic needs of the philosophic predisposition, the predisposition that, however discreetly, asks embarrassing questions of the world. Questions like, is this society we are fond of a good society? Is this life we are comfortably and familiarly attached to a good life? I am not one of those who believes that the unexamined life is not worth living. That is one of the most ridiculous assertions ever made by a literary intellectual. On the other hand, it is no less ridiculous to suggest that the unexamined life is identical with the good life. And though I cannot think that Oakeshott really believes this, he comes perilously close to saying it. To be sure, if we were supremely confident that we were, in fact, leading a good life in a good society, then the conservative predisposition would be the same thing as the philosophical predisposition. It may be possible, or it may once have been possible, for Englishmen to be so splendidly confident about their national condition. But I doubt that this confidence was ever fully justified. And in any case, those of us who have not had the good fortune to be born British are left with our anxieties. On a less elevated level, I find myself wondering how on earth this conservative predisposition can prosper in a world that is not only in a constant state of flux, but is committed to flux by reason of its prior commitment to personal liberty and economic improvement. In our world, people are encouraged not to have a conservative predisposition. What, one wonders, are Mr. Oakeshott's intentions toward this state of affairs? Is he in favor of restricting advertising? Does he wish to slow down the rate of technological innovation? And if so, how would he do it without giving the state enormous new powers? Does he wish to abolish installment buying? Is he for circumscribing the freedom and power of the mass media? And again, how would he accomplish this without undue interference with personal liberty? One knows from Mr. Oakeshott's other writings how strongly he prizes individual liberty. What one does not know, what he has never explained, is how the kind of individual liberty we have today is to be reconciled with the conservative predisposition, which he also prizes. I am not blaming Mr. Oakeshott for not knowing the answers to these questions, since I don't know them either, and I sometimes wonder whether such answers exist. But all that this means is that being a conservative today, in the sense of having a conservative predisposition, is a very problematic enterprise. One really doesn't know what to do with this conservative predisposition. One of the things you can do is to affix yourself to a critical posture that deplores modernity itself for raising such intractable questions. This is Mr. Russell Kirk's strategy, and within its limits, it is a very useful one. In a way, it is a strategy for converting a conservative predisposition into Tory energy. I do not use that term Tory in a derogatory way. I appreciate Mr. Kirk's writings and share many of his values. But no one can say, and he would be the last to say, that he is familiarly at home in the modern world, that he is attached to things as they are, that he is fond of things as they are, that he would be grieved if things changed from what they are. On the contrary, it is quite clear that he detests most things as they are, that he is very angry at the world he lives in, that he esteems only those existing things that have a clear connection with a remote antiquity. I'm not even sure that Mr. Kirk would like to be a conservative in the same way I would. He has an adventurousness of spirit. There is a romantic quality to his imagination which marks the true-born Tory. It is hard to conceive of Mr. Kirk not being nostalgic no matter when he was born. And such nostalgia, of course, being the primordial source of all poetry and much religion, must evoke a response in any man of sensibility. Having said this, I must also go on to say that, as I see it, Toryism is essentially a literary posture rather than a political one. It's one of the most decent and humane of the literary postures available today. But while I would encourage statesmen to read Mr. Kirk, I would not expect them to find him of much practical help in coping with the modern world, even if they were statesmen of conservative predisposition. We today are all caught up in a huge historical tempest, lost at sea, and we consider ourselves lucky if we can get both hands on the rudder. Under those circumstances, there's not much profit in reflecting aloud on how much better things would have been had we never left port. I'd much prefer to hear some informed guesses as to the nearest harbor, one not infested with savages, if possible. I must admit to not knowing quite what to do with Milton Friedman. On the one hand, he rejects the conservative label and insists he is some kind of 19th century radical lib. On the other hand, he is widely regarded, especially by the business community, as a conservative defender of the free enterprise system. I suppose that, through some strenuous dialectics, these two points of view could be reconciled in theory. In practice, however, I think one has to be guided by public opinion and public definitions rather than private ones. Though the free enterprise system under which we live may not be as free or as enterprising as Mr. Friedman would like, it is a real enough thing, and one who defends it can legitimately be called a conservative. I also seriously doubt that a 19th century businessman would be as impressed by Mr. Friedman as is his 20th century counterpart. The bourgeois ethos of the 19th century is not Mr. Friedman's ethos. Indeed, that bourgeois ethos is markedly at odds with his libertarian and free enterprise ethos. Imagine Soames Forsyte running into Milton Friedman at the Reform Club. I've got the right club, haven't I, Milton?
Yeah.
Right. Their conversation might, at the outset, have been most amiable as they chatted about the stupidity of politicians and the merits of laissez-faire. But I cannot see how this amiability could have lasted beyond those first few moments. And I fear that Mr. Forsyte would have quickly come to regard Mr. Friedman as an eccentric bohemian, a decidedly unsound man. Mr. Forsyte, like most 19th century liberals, may have had his personal doubts about the existence of God, but he would have had no doubt at all about the importance of organized religion and about the desirability of the government's sustaining organized religion. He would not, for instance, have had the slightest qualms about laws which punished blasphemy. Similarly, Mr. Forsyte would have believed that personal moral conduct fell within the scope of law, in the form, say, of legislation with regard to adultery, homosexuality, pornography, and so on. Mr. Forsyte's laissez-faire, it would quickly have become apparent, did not extend very far beyond the marketplace, and Mr. Friedman's libertarian notions of individual freedom would have struck him as anarchistic and irresponsible. Moreover, had the conversation lasted long enough, which I doubt, it would have become apparent that even with regard to business and businessmen, they had profoundly different attitudes. For Mr. Forsyte, laissez-faire meant only that government should not try to substitute legislative fiat for the economic laws of the marketplace. It most emphatically did not mean that businessmen were not to be governed by a strict moral code, or that businessmen were to be concerned only with the rational pursuit of profit. I know of no better illustration of this than the bourgeois attitude toward bankruptcy, an attitude very different from that of our spokesman for free enterprise today. To Mr. Forsyte and his friends, bankruptcy was no mere economic fact. It was a shame and a disgrace. Bankruptcy testified not simply to bad luck or bad management. It testified to a deep flaw in moral character. You didn't want your sister to marry a man who had been bankrupt. because he was the kind of man who did not responsibly meet his obligations. In Mr. Forsythe's world, a man who went bankrupt and then spent his entire life paying off his creditors, even though he had no legal duty to do so, such a man was honorable. In Mr. Friedman's world, which is our world, such a man would be viewed as some kind of a nut. What this comes down to is that Mr. Forsythe's belief in laissez-faire did not interfere with his conviction that successful businessmen were to cultivate some of the traditional attributes of a ruling class. That is to say, the bourgeois businessman was to serve not simply as a model of success, but also as a model of virtue and propriety. Never mind whether or not this model was a particularly glorious or even attractive one. It was an authentic model deeply believed in, and not by businessmen alone, but by a good part, perhaps a majority, of the population. In this model, personal virtue and personal merit had some connection with worldly success and a high social position. The connection may have been established after the event, as often as not. A great many crooks and scoundrels, once they made their fortunes, were quick to assume the airs of respectability and to make themselves over into model bourgeois characters. But this itself testifies to the power that the model exercised over men's imaginations. Not every bourgeois businessman had, in fact, the pristine character of a Horatio Alger hero. Probably very few did. But they accepted this character as their ideal type and tried very hard, at least in public, to approximate it. Today, our most powerful businessmen, the top corporate executives, are men of a different breed. One knows little of their personal lives, and one couldn't care less. They do not think of themselves as a ruling class, and the only model they propose to us is that of managerial efficiency, a model, that is to say, of a function, not of an individual and not of a class. One may be deferential to them out of prudence, so long as they hold corporate office. One has no deference to their persons, and they expect no such deference. They succeed to the extent that they increase earnings per share. They fail to the extent that they do not. Their existence has no other justification. They are their economic performance, as we say, and this performance is measured in strictly utilitarian terms. Mr. Forsythe was not unfamiliar with this kind of one-dimensional businessman. He called them speculators, and he tried never to let them into his club. I can already hear Mr. Friedman intervening urbanely. For goodness sake, who on earth wants businessmen to serve as a model? They are supposed to be useful people, not admirable people. And since he is no kind of a snob, Mr. Friedman would surely go on to say the same thing about economists or professors or magazine editors. The objection has a specious plausibility, since we all know businessmen and economists and professors and magazine editors who, so far from being suitable models to the young, ought to be kept at a safe distance from them. But that's not the issue. The issue is whether, when men live together in society, they live together as a social order in which classes and institutions have moral legitimacy, or rather, merely as an aggregate of social functions whose claims to legitimacy are dependent simply upon efficient performance. A 19th century liberal believed that laissez-faire, when wedded to what we now call the Protestant ethic, could be an integral part of a bourgeois social order. A 20th century conservative believes that free enterprise in a free society is a substitute for a social order. Mr. Friedman is such a 20th century conservative. He is not a 19th century liberal, as he sometimes says, because 19th century liberalism was in the main bourgeois liberalism, and Mr. Friedman's cast of mind is decidedly post-bourgeois. So the question that confronts me is, if one wants to be a conservative, why shouldn't one be Mr. Friedman's kind of conservative? I could answer that question in two ways. I could say, first of all, that I don't really like the ideal of free enterprise in a free society as much as Mr. Friedman does. But there was a more important objection. In practice, I believe that this kind of 20th century conservatism is self-defeating, that it does not lead to a tranquil life, but rather leads, or perhaps I should say, has led and will lead to social convulsions. And there is not much point of being a conservative if it results in societies having a series of fits and seizures, the very condition that conservatism most abhors. The trouble with our kind of free society and the utilitarian thinking, the materialist thinking on which it rests, is that it makes dubious the legitimacy of all institutions, the family, the church, the state, the corporation itself. Arguments from utility seem clear enough when presented in the mathematical language of economics. They have, however, but little bearing on the real world, where it is extremely difficult to judge whether or not an institution is working efficiently and where the blame or the credit lies. Take the business corporation. During periods of prosperity, almost all corporations look good. During periods of recession, they almost all look bad. And in addition to the major swings of the business cycle, there are always smaller swings within particular markets that affect the so-called performance of any corporation. People talk glibly about well-managed corporations, but there is, in fact, very little consensus, even among knowledgeable observers, as to which is which and when. The best informed observers are, I suppose, on Wall Street. And there, the cynical wisdom of the street is always discount for management. To survive such cynicism, and I should say it is a cynicism appropriate to the management of any institution in the complexities of the real world, an institution needs a claim to legitimacy on other than utilitarian grounds. Oh, yes, business corporations do go bankrupt, as Mr. Friedman is fond of pointing out. From this, he draws the neo-Hegelian conclusion, what exists is legitimate, what is bankrupt is not. I fear that such a definition of legitimacy is inadequate, to put it mildly. The original legitimacy of the business corporation was based on a theory of private property. This was a bourgeois theory, in that corporate executives and directors could, as surrogates for the stockholder, claim a right to their prerogatives, just as a small shopkeeper could claim the right to his shop and to the perquisites thereof. This right rested on the assumption that the right to property was identical with the right to the fruits of one's labor, one's diligence, one's thrift, one's foresight. In short, on one's possession of the bourgeois virtues. Obviously, status and power and wealth that derive from the exercise of virtues could not be anything but legitimate. Equally obviously, this bourgeois conception of property has little relevance to the American corporation today, in which stockholders and management are, in effect, partners in speculation. They are wildly unequal partners. The number of prominent business executives who took cuts in salary equivalent to the drop in value of their company shares during the recent unpleasantness on Wall Street can be counted on the fingers of one hand, perhaps even on the fingers of no hand. But that is only a marginal issue. The main issue is whether the American corporation as it exists today has a plausible claim to autonomy, and autonomy is simply another way of saying legitimacy. Corporations affect the lives of too many people for management to argue persuasively that their sole or even major responsibility is to those who trade shares on the stock exchange. Already, a great many people are wondering why the people who now sit on the boards of directors are there, and whether it might not be a good idea to have some directors whose loyalties are not to the great speculative game. It is easy to predict that this kind of thinking will gain momentum. But it will be said that whatever the theoretical doubts about the legitimacy of our existing economic arrangements, there can be no doubt that they do promote dynamic economic change and growth. I agree. There can be no doubt about it. And I think this constitutes another problem for the conservative. Anyone who is genuinely conservative has to be worried about dynamic change and growth. He should, of course, be accepting of slow, gradual, organic change and growth. A conservative is not a man who believes that time and history should come to a stop now that they have produced so perfect a creature as himself. But dynamism is not a feature of the world he ordinarily finds congenial. The trouble with dynamism, as he sees it, is that it upsets and confuses people. It strains the bonds of civility, and it encourages all sorts of human appetites to flourish at the expense of contentment and happiness. Now, I have to be careful here, because what I am going to say may sound sacrilegious even to rather friendly ears. I have to face the inevitable question as to whether I really am in favor of a somewhat slower rate of economic growth, a slower rate in the diminution of poverty, a slower rate of improvement in the material well-being of the population. It is not an easy question to face up to. But after thinking this over for a long time, I have come to the only possible conclusion. Yes, if one wishes to be a conservative, one has to answer all these questions in the affirmative. I have little doubt that this may sound bizarre to those who believe that happiness consists in the incessant satisfaction of desires. If you are a conservative, however, you will not find it hard to believe that happiness has more to do with a fond attachment to familiar things and to familiar ways, that to the extent that such familiarity is disrupted by rapid economic improvement, as measured by economists and statisticians, people become anxious, uneasy, suspicious, aggressive, neurasthenic. To the conservative, therefore, slow and gradual economic growth, at a tempo that permits people to accommodate themselves to it with the least disruption of their settled habits, is much to be preferred to rapid and dynamic growth. And in this respect, I think, the conservative finds himself more in accord with the majority of his fellow citizens than either he or they realize. True, the materialist hedonist values of our age are so firmly established that few people are likely to challenge them openly. But I do not think one can understand the history of our times unless one acknowledges the degree to which it has been shaped by an urge to escape from the kind of freedom that prevails in a free society. Totalitarian movements are an obvious and grotesque case in point. But the welfare state, too, though it is in part the product of individual and collective greed, an appetite that the free society itself continually stimulates, is also in part a conservative effort to bring stability back into the social order, even if this has adverse consequences for economic growth. Perhaps if one could be more candid about this, if we permitted our statesmen to be more candid about it, our welfare state would not be so messy, since it would not be trying to achieve the incompatible objectives of increasing universal affluence and achieving general stability. But such candor is regarded as political suicide. The sad truth is that it is very difficult to be a candid conservative, what I would call a conservative today. Indeed, I should say that the major task facing American society is reforming itself in such a way as to make it possible for people to begin to be candidly conservative. Just what reforms would accomplish this objective, it is extremely difficult to say. But I think one has to say openly that at least some of them would, to one degree or another, circumscribe individual and corporate liberty and would be profoundly offensive to all libertarians. Some, but not all. One of the truly admirable aspects of Milton Friedman's intellectual creativity is the way in which he manages to propose reforms that serve both individual liberty and social stability. His ideas on the financing of education are, to my view, an excellent case in point, and his recommendation of a modest guaranteed minimum income to replace our present welfare system is another. Moreover, he has no peer in showing how various aspects of the welfare state, presumed to create stability, in fact operate to a perverse effect. So I find myself always learning from him and agreeing with him on specifics far more frequently than one might expect. But delightful though such agreement is, I am also aware that it has its limits. The libertarian cause, the cause which favors free enterprise in a free society, is not mine. I also happen to think it is a lost cause, and that what will kill it, if nothing else, is the progress of science and technology that a free society encourages. In the not too distant future, we shall be living in a world in which any group of clever young men with criminal or insane purpose will be able to construct a rudimentary atom bomb, or to produce a deadly nerve gas, or to manufacture pills that have disastrous genetic effects. When that happens, and I don't see how it can fail to happen, scientific and technological knowledge will become secret knowledge, and the free circulation of such knowledge will be prohibited. The repercussions upon our political, economic, and educational systems are almost too enormous to contemplate, and not less disagreeable. But obviously they will spell the end of the free society as we now know it. But this is by the way. Let me leave that nightmarish prospect. Perhaps a miracle will somehow spare us from it, and suggest instead that there are other kinds of reforms, usually thought to be liberal rather than conservative, which might make this nation more fit for conservatives to inhabit. For example, it seems to me that our corporations need to acquire some new increments of legitimacy, since the older sources of legitimacy are so depleted by now. I am not entirely clear as to what direction this should take, but I do know that the present system of government by managers, whose sole function is to increase earnings per share, is becoming less acceptable every day. Though Americans love the stock market, they really don't want to be governed by it. The present movement toward placing on the boards of our very large corporations directors who represent the public interest is, I believe, a genuine response to an unnatural situation, even if the motives of the people urging this reform are frequently of a kind that I do not admire. Something of the sort is, I should say, inevitable. Just who these public members should be and precisely what their assignment ought to be is still unclear. Presumably, there will be many professors among them. And this could be a good thing. We have created a core of tens of thousands of professors who are interested in neither research nor teaching and not particularly competent in either. They exist, they are not going to go away, and it is terribly important that we civilize them. Some public recognition, an expense account, and a tiny bit of power might work usefully toward that end. And who knows, some of them may turn out to be pretty good businessmen, which is what some of them should have been in the first place. There are other specific reforms that I would be willing to contemplate, at least in a preliminary way. Any legislation that curbed expenditures for advertising would seem to me to be a move in the right direction. Our appetites are too freely stimulated today, in my opinion. And I think the government ought to subsidize home ownership even more generously and more vigorously than it does today. And I believe our Social Security payments should be considerably more generous than they are now, and that they should be paid for out of general revenues. Older people are naturally conservative, and we therefore ought to cherish them more than we do. But I shall stop my agenda of reform right here, lest it degenerate into the fun and games of constitution making. I do not insist on the importance or effectiveness or even sensibleness of any one of these reforms, but something like them is needed. Our free society, whatever its merits otherwise, is a society that drinks the blood of its own institutions, draining them of legitimacy, and thereby it provokes perpetual unrest and unease among the citizens. We need more stability, more calm, and above all, a more tranquil sense that things are not, after all, in the saddle. To attain this conservative condition, we need a reforming spirit, a spirit that one ordinarily associates with the liberal rather than the conservative temper. And that is why, when I am asked whether I am a liberal or a conservative, I find it so difficult to answer. For I am frequently the one, but always in order to be the other.